How do you know if you're for real? How do you know if you are for real? Think about it for 8 seconds. Think about it for 8 seconds, then I'm going to take your answers. How do you know if you're for real? Think. How do you know if you're for real? All right, let me hear it. What are your answers? How do you know if you're for real? I heard you say you're for real. How do you know if you're for real, Sonia? Oh, we're created in the image of God, and that's a pretty good image. That's a legit sort of image. Yes, sir. How do you know if you're for real? You feel. That's interesting, right? You know that you're for real because, I mean, you feel an experience, right? It's sort of this subjective experience. That's really interesting. Mike? So we have like, how do I know I'm for real? I think. How do I know I'm for real? I think. No, excuse me. I feel. I think. I think, therefore, I am. Cogito ergo sum. As the great philosopher said. Yeah, how about you, Trey? Oh, how do you know if you're for real? Because you do something about it. This is kind of the hot spot right now in the congregation. You guys, all right, way in the back. Samuel, how do you know if you're for real? I'm sorry? Oh, you got to be tested. Oh, okay, so there's a veteran response. You know if you're for real, if you're pushed, if you're tested, right? You're proven. Yeah, that's interesting. What you got, Vern? How do you know if you're for real?
I'm the same in public
as I am in private. Oh, see, this is an interesting, it's a different angle for answering it, but another good one, right? I know if I'm for real if I'm the same in public as I am in private. What does that tell you? Well, that tells you that you're not faking anywhere, right? That you're consistent, that you're just you. Who's that, Malia back there? What do you got, honey? You know if you're for real if you pray to God, because the answer is always pray or Jesus. She's doing great. Good answers. Yes, sir. If you're disgusted by sin, this is sort of a moral answer. Everybody's taking a different angle on the question, but it's really cool. You know if you're for real, ... with God, ... If you're disgusted by sin, if you're offended by the things that offend him, right? If you have sort of similar perspectives and tastes and passions, then you know that your faith is for real. Sora.
The way my kids reflect me.
Oh, so many good answers. I think I've learned this morning not to preach at all, but just to have people stand up and talk. So Sora knows she's for real depending on how her kids reflect her, right? Is she projecting into the world a healthy reality? Well, her kids who project it back to her are going to tell her. They're going to tell her if her love is for real and truth is for real and faith is for real. That's a great answer. It's a great answer. Was it June? Did you have one?
You just know it
In yourself. Which sounds like a really simple answer, but what it does is it appeals to self-honesty, right? So you know it within yourself, provided that you're an honest man, right? And so honesty is just a super undervalued virtue. All right, one last answer. Who's got the best answer? Thanks, man. How do you know if you're for real? No, I got an answer from you. You have another one? You can pretend? Oh, you can. So you can pretend you have seen yourself do it, and you know what that feels like, right? And therefore, you know what the difference is, right? So you've had some experiences. Also, a great answer. It's worth knowing if you're for real, right? You agree with that statement? Is it worth knowing if you're for real? I think for a lot of people, it's not. I think a lot of people don't care if they're for real. I think people care about, you know, how they're perceived until things go badly. When your foundations get swept out from under you, right? When you go through one of those times in life where everything kind of falls apart on you, then it's worth knowing whether or not you're for real. Or I could say, then it's worth knowing what is real about you and trustworthy about you, as opposed to what is false about you and not trustworthy about you. Because in tough times, you might wonder if your faking. And when you have tough times with God, and we go through those times with God, right? That when we wonder what's going on with him. We wonder if he's that into us after all. You know, we go through times like that. And during those times especially, it's worth knowing if you are for real, if what you have with God is for real. For instance, we're doing this sermon series on seeking after God, just seeking God, which sounds really general. But we talked about how seeking God is one of those skills that gets super undervalued. We talk a lot about believing in God or trusting God or serving with God. We talk a lot about following God. But just seeking after God is where it started for most of us. And once we learn to seek God, we must never stop seeking God because seasons come and go, life changes, things evolve. Seeking after God, seeking revelation from God, Jesus says, is actually the secret to the kingdom of heaven on earth. If you are a seeker, you'll be able to stick with the kingdom of heaven on earth. If you never quite learn to seek, then you may well be in trouble. So we've talked about the necessary skill of seeking in this sermon series. And then we talked about different stories of people seeking God, different Bible stories and conditions in which people sought after God. We talked about seeking God and exhaustion. That was a story about Elijah. We talked about being the sort of person who seeks God as opposed to seeking things from God, which is a differentiation that most of us need to learn to make at a certain point. It's good to have things from God. It's good to seek blessing from the Lord. But it's also good just to know somebody who's just friends with God, you know, and maybe you want to be that somebody in the world. And today we're going to talk about seeking God for real, which is to say seeking God when you could reasonably say that you have an excuse not to, when you could fake it. Or you could check out and seeking God during those times. I've made no secret that in recent years I've gone through a super tough time in my life, probably you know the hardest time of my life to date. I don't like to tell stories about recent seasons in my life for a number of reasons. One, because they don't necessarily tie up nicely, right? If they're super recent, then you know ripples might still be going on, and so it's hard for me to kind of present you a tale that is fully accurate and trustworthy. There's that. Another reason I don't tell a lot of stories from my recent life is because they involve people you might know. And so right now, everybody, just look at the person that you're thinking of that might be, you know, the thorn in my side, you know. The focus of my story. Oh, it's really hard. So, you know, I talk about these things generally. It's a little bit unavoidably, but, you know, those of you who have, you know, walked through seasons with me, you know that this last one, these last several years were particularly hard for me. The season involved deaths of multiple loved ones, you know, so that's always hard. It involved the unjust destruction of several long-term projects that I and my family had deeply sacrificed for. And they all kind of blew up and left us bereft. It involved betrayal and the theft of most of my worldly wealth and sort of unjust debt obligation now that we're wrestling with. Huge relational losses over the past several years for me and for a lot of us as we've gone through you know COVID and all that, you know, plus there was COVID and all that and all the, you know, the overly passionate controversies that went along with that, and they really affected me and my family a lot. Huge costs for us. And then we went through, like, Blue Water lost its building. We couldn't meet as a church for basically 2 years. We lost two-thirds of the church, which is, you know, hard for anybody in the church. Maybe a little particularly hard for the guy sitting on top of it. A lot of coping and compensation work that I had to do as a result of that. And then at the end of it all, there was sort of the exhaustion of having to replant the church, essentially, in a different place, you know. And it's doing okay now. You can look around and judge for yourself. All right, so it's an ongoing story, but I had so many moments. Oh my gosh, just so many blisteringly difficult moments from the last several years. One I was thinking about this week was when Jeremiah and I, my son and I, went to clean up the home of my biological mother, whom had passed away in the home, and the place was just. My mother, God love her. I didn't know her that well, didn't know her at all growing up, got to know her a little bit later in life, and my kids got to know her a little bit, but, you know, she had her struggles. She was sort of a lifelong addict. She lived in a cabin on the North Oregon coast, and she's a bit of a hoarder, and cleaning up the house was sort of surreal, you know, and she had died in the home, and I was cleaning up some of her in a lot of ways. And I just remember thinking that God was nowhere in my life. You know, and we all go through difficult seasons where you have something, you know, I mean, life is terminal, right? So you go through seasons in which, you know, you wrestle with death and stuff like that. The toughest seasons for me are the ones in which things stack up, you know? And I remember relating to God a lot during those years, those difficult months. First, I relate to him sadly, you know, because I was just quivering with grief 24/7 for months on end. And then because I'm a guy, that grief turned into anger, because that's what we do, right? That's how we sort of get ourselves galvanized. To face the day, so there's a lot of anger, and that caused secondary and tertiary problems. And I just had this moment where I thought, man, where do I even start with you, God? You ever been there? You sort of feeling it anyway? You feeling it? The story, like, where do I even start? I mean, what the heck? I've given you every opportunity a man could give to bless me. You know, I'm basically a decent fellow. And it seems like you've taken every opportunity to pull the rug out from under my feet and visit me with suffering. So where do I even start with that? And then I thought of this story from my own life. Because life, you know, it goes around, doesn't it? and a difficult time that I had gone through when I was a teenager. Now, I was not an enlightened teenager like Bella, right? I was a little stormier, and maybe didn't have the great youth group around her, so many loving aunties and uncles speaking truth into her. But you know, I had some friends who would take me to this church, and I remember heard some stories about some Old Testament characters who would build altars to God when things were dramatic or dramatically good in their lives, and stones of remembrance and stuff like that. I didn't know what they were. But in the backyard of this house where I was living, I had this pathetic little garden where I grew hot peppers because I really liked them. And so this is what I did. I was going through a really terrible time. Mostly it was a scary time. I just felt very unstable and vulnerable in my life. So I got a rock. I got a rock. And I dug a hole in my garden, and I set it there so that, you know, most of it was sticking out. And that was my rock. Why did I do that? That was my rock of remembrance before the Lord. What the heck was I accomplishing there? I did that. Why? Okay, so just think about that. Because I remembered that experience as something that was valuable to me. I do tenacity really well in life. You know, I'm the guy that's going to go down with the ship. I'll be the last guy on station in life. But what I don't do well in life is sincerity, by which I mean I will do the right thing but feel junk about it the whole time. Right? So inside, I'll be a storm. I'll be all divided and stuff like that. How do you navigate those internal storms is the question. And our text today is from Psalm 63. Again, we're just doing stories of seeking, right? And this is a story about a guy named David who wrote the bulk of the Psalms that we have in the Bible. He was a songwriter, among other lesser important things, like, you know, king and conqueror and stuff like that. But he was a musician, and he was a worshiper. And the Psalms are great. I went through and counted them up once. I would say, by my count, about 65% of the Psalms would be in the blues category. By which I mean there's some element within the psalm. Every psalm is a song, right? So there's some element in the song that's like, you know, yeah, you know, my wife left me, my dog ran off, my truck broke down, you know, so it's kind of blues. And then they usually have some sort of worshipful refrain. Even though those things are bad, Lord, you are good. And that's like a good 65, 70% of the psalms follow that. So this one, Psalm 63, is one of my favorite psalms of that times are hard genre. Psalm 63 was written by David when he was young. He was probably still a teenager when he wrote this, actually. And what was happening in David's life was that things had gone horribly wrong for him at this moment. Everybody knows the story of the young David slaying Goliath with a sling, right? Everybody knows that. And then he became a national hero overnight. Well, that was pretty good. That's a high. Then he was invited into the king's household and given a spot of honor. And he was just sort of a valued member, a counselor, would become a military commander for the king. He wrote songs to soothe the king who was having a troubled life. He became best buddies with the king's oldest son, a man named Jonathan. And so things were going well for a while, but then the king, a guy named Saul, became very jealous of David. You know this story? Tried to kill him a couple times and basically drove him off because David was too beloved for what he had done for the country. And so Saul decides that he's going to assassinate David. So David runs off, having not done anything wrong, only done things that are good, only done things that are brave, only done things that are godly, only done things that are worshipful. He runs for his life. He's a fugitive in his own country by decree of the king. And he's got assassination squads scouring the country looking for him. That's his life. So he's living underground. At this time, he's living underground literally. He's actually living in a cave in a remote corner of the desert in the Judean countryside. So he is gone in a place that is so harsh and remote that nobody lives there. So he had to go like way, way out there. And he's living in a cave, getting by however he can, you know, scrounging for bird eggs, and drinking from any stream that he can find. That's his life. And this is what he writes during that period. He writes this song. Oh God, you are my God. Earnestly I seek you. My soul thirsts for you. My whole being longs for you. Some translations say, and my body longs for you in a dry and weary land where there is no water. I've seen you in the sanctuary. I beheld your power and your glory. Because your love is better than life, my lips will glorify you. I will praise you as long as I live. And in your name, I will lift up my hands. Just like appreciate what these lines mean in the context of which he is writing it. Your love is better than life. So that's a powerful thing to say if you think you might not survive the week. Right? My soul will be satisfied as with the richest of foods. With singing lips, my mouth will praise you. On my bed, I remember you. And his bed was probably like, you know, dirt. I think of you through the watches of the night. Well, he would have to watch during the night lest he get snuck up on. Because you are my help, I sing in the shadow of your wings. My soul clings to you. Your right hand upholds me. They who seek my life will be destroyed. They will go down to the depths of the earth. They will be given over to the sword and become food for jackals. Well, there's a twist. By the way, everyone who seeks to destroy me will instead be destroyed themselves. But the king will rejoice in God. All who swear by God's name will praise him. Well, that's an interesting thing to say in the straits in which he finds himself. All who swear by God's name will praise him, while the mouths of the liars will be silenced. And there's confidence that he's going to get justice in the end. The thing about David and all the stories that you read about him in Scripture is that he knew who he was with God, right? He never doubted the strength of his relationship with God. David did some great things. David did some very nasty things in the Bible, murder and adultery and stuff like that. The guy was like, you know, he was like that hitter in baseball who either hits a home run or strikes out, you know, highs and lows. But he never doubted the reality of his relationship with God. You know, he would have said, yeah, I'm for real. Oh, I'm a mess, but I'm for real. And I think you see that reflected in this psalm. The first thing he says, it sounds so ordinary that you might skip over it. You're my God. Oh, God, you are my God. Well, I mean, that's it, though, isn't it? I mean, that's the thing. He's lost everything. Like, he might not survive the week. Assassination squads are scouring his home, trying to kill him. He's lying there in a cave, and he says, yeah, but I have a God, don't I? And you're it. You're it. You know, you're my God with everything that involves. I have a God, and you're it. So let's start there, sir. It's just a revolutionary and defiant and foundational thing to say. Oh, yeah. But I have a God. But I have a God. Whatever's going on in your life, you know, whatever destruction, whatever disappointment, whatever hidden struggles, you know, it's worth shaking it off every once in a while. Looking in the mirror and saying, yeah. But I have a God, don't I? I have a God, don't I? I think it's the most powerful line in the whole psalm because I appreciate the context in which he said it and what was really going on for him. I think, you are my God. And then basically he says, I know you're big and trustworthy and praiseworthy, you know. So, you know, it's worth having you in my life. In fact, it's worth seeking you. I will seek you accordingly. You know, that's the thing about having a God. Seeking him is worth it. And there's a lot in the psalm about that. Your love is better than life. So, you know, of course my lips are going to glorify you. Of course I'm going to sing to you. I still have a voice, don't I? That's kind of the attitude of the psalm. I'll praise you as long as I live. And I don't care if I die on Tuesday. I'm going to praise you till Tuesday. Because, you know, I have a God. And right now I have some lips. In your name, I will lift up my hands. Like whatever I got, you know, because I have a God, you know. If you're nonverbal and terribly introverted and don't have any musical skill, maybe you make a rock garden. I don't know. I don't know. But you have a God, don't you? So figure out some way to seek him. That's kind of what David is saying here. I will live accordingly, no matter what. And then you get to the end, toward the end of the psalm, where it says, they who seek my life will be destroyed. And it sounds almost like an afterthought when it comes in at the end, doesn't it? I would have led with that, probably, if I were writing a psalm in the cave being hunted by assassination squads. I would be like, Lord, just so you remember, that's how I would have started my psalm, people are trying to kill me. You're big, you're powerful. Get the job done. That kind of would have been the shape of my psalm. But he's like, you're my God. You're kind of awesome. I seek you no matter what, with all of my being and without compromise. By the way, some folks are trying to kill me. They'll probably get destroyed. In the end, the king will come to his senses and praise you. That's kind of how it goes. Things will work out somehow. However, anyway, back to the seeking. There's sort of a defiant, worshipful quality in this. And I have found in my life that a lot of the best worship is actually defiant. You know, it's defiant vis-a-vis the struggles of my life, as opposed to responsorial to the good things in my life. If good things happen to you, it's pretty easy to be like, oh, God, you're keen. That's what the kids say these days. But when a lot of cruddy things happen in your life, you know, sometimes the best songs come from there. The best songs of my soul come from those moments, because it's just naked praise, you know. It's wrapped up in nothing. It's just pure that way. It's sincere. That's how you know it's sincere. That's how you know it's for real. That word sincere comes from a old English, old French word that simply means one thing, pure, you know. So it's sincere that way. This is sincere praise, because there's not any reason for it other than you have a God. You have a God. I think the big lesson from the psalm, though, is not what's written in it. You could tear it apart, parse it. There are things in here that a good worshiper would want to imitate. But I think like the main point of this psalm is not what's written in it. It's the fact that it was written at all. That's the story. That's the story of this psalm. That when you think you're probably going to die, either from starvation, thirst, or hit squads, betrayal, write yourself a song somehow. Now create something artful. In and of itself, a song, you know, doesn't have a lot of merit. You know, a dance might not have a lot of merit. A rock garden might not have a lot of merit. But the fact that you would do it has a lot of merit, has a lot of power in your life. Why do you suppose he composed this? Why do you suppose he wrote this down? Well, he wouldn't have written it down, actually, because I'm sure he had no writing utensils. What he done is he would have created it and memorized it, and my imagine recited it to himself every day in the cave, I think is probably what happened. And then later on, some scribe wrote it down because he said, oh, I had this ditty that I used to sing, you know, back when I was living in a cave and people were trying to kill me. Well, how did it go, King? Ah. God, you are my God. I will seek you in a dry and thirsty land. I will seek you. Why? Why did he do that? Well, I think it's because he needed to know that he was for real. That he was for real in his relationship with God. And that was kind of the first step toward experiencing God being real. Right? Because if you're faking, then you're not going to trust God very much, right? This is David saying, I'm for real. I'm for real. And I think you're for real. That's enough for today. That's what was going on. It was to exercise reality. To exercise reality. That's why he wrote it. All right, my thought for the day, as we wrapped up then, is this, you're only for real if you're the same no matter the conditions. That's how you know. And a lot of you in your answers earlier in the morning said as much, but it was interesting to me that you said it 8 or 9 different ways. But we instinctively know this, right? We know that we're for real if we're the same no matter the conditions. We're for real if we act the same way sad as we do when we're happy. We know that we're for real if we act the same way when we're poor as we do when we're rich. We know that we're for real if we act exactly the same when we're lonely as when we're popular, as when we're wanted, when we're rejected. That's really the ultimately the only way to know that you're for real. A little corollary lesson is I think sometimes one of the reasons that God sends testing times into our life is because he wants us to know that we're for real. I mean, he knows we're for real, but maybe we don't. Maybe we don't. And so he visits us with tough times. Sometimes he visits us with extraordinarily tough times. Sometimes he takes away everything in your life except you. You know, and you're the only thing left. And you find yourself, you know, poorly clothed, all alone in a cave with everybody in the world trying to kill you. You know those seasons? How many of you like the death squad? And, well, it depends how you lived, I suppose. But when you've got nothing but you, you find out a lot about you, don't you? So I think that might have been partly what was going on here. You're only real if you're the same, no matter the conditions. God is real because he's the same, no matter the conditions. And that's the thing that you celebrate in your worship. If you can manage to do that, you're seeking. You're seeking reality amidst temporary conditions. You're seeking the deeper reality. And at the heart of any deep reality is God himself. If you understand that God is the same, no matter the conditions, that he's your God, that he's wonderful, that he's worth seeking no matter the conditions. If you can do that, boom, you're a seeker. You've nailed it. You've nailed it. And even in a dry and thirsty land, you can write psalms for the ages. If nothing else, you're in a good position to be delivered. How that happens or if it happens is up to the Lord, I suppose. But, guys, I see you. I know that a lot of you are in tough seasons. I know that for a lot of you, foundations have been swept away or things that you dreamt about in life, they're just not going to happen. You know, and I know how that feels in the gut. I know how surreal it feels, you know, when you just find yourself time after time just cleaning up after deaths, you know. I know exactly how that feels and how it seems that God just hasn't held up his end of the bargain. And it's tempting to think that, oh, you know, maybe God's not even real, or maybe his love for me isn't real. And in those moments, the proper thing to do is to declare reality in some fashion. And I don't care how you do it. You can write a song. You can plant a rock. You can make an investment. You can go find somebody equally miserable and love them. You're making a declaration of reality. You guys are at least as creative as I am. The question is, do you just get swept away by the flood, or do you reach out for God? Can you seek God even when it seems as if he's treated you poorly? And let me just put an edge on that, and this will be our application point for the day, our application question, if you will. Can you seek God reverently, even though he's treated you poorly? Does God sometimes treat you poorly? Yeah, have you read the book of Job? Right, like he can give you tough conditions, right? That's what I mean. When he does that, you can seek God through complaint, right? And this is a little bit of what Elijah did. We read his story a couple of weeks ago. You know, it's like he went out to Mount Oreb in the middle of the wilderness. He was really depressed, suicidally depressed. I love him so much. And, and he complained to God, and God accepted it and dealt with him, and, you know, it worked out okay. But this is not that. This is being in the middle of nowhere in a cave and seeking God reverently. He had a lot to complain about. God, I've done nothing, but goodness, I saved the entire country. I risked my life to do it. And right now, a bunch of assassination squads are trying to kill me. Doesn't even say that. He just assumes, my would-be murderers will be destroyed. It'll be okay. But he's quite reverent. You're my God. I seek you. As a man seeks water in a dry and thirsty land. Can you seek God reverently even though he treats you poorly? Oh my gosh, you know what a triumph that is if you pull that off? You know how amazing that makes you? You know how real that makes you if you can be reverent when you are treated irreverently? If you can bow before the Lord, even though you feel as if you're bowed into the dust anyway? That's really what's happening. And so I like to put things sort of in conceptual oppositions. If there's a difference between saying to God, "Where are you?" and saying to God, "I seek you." And if you understand that difference, I think you get it. I think you get it. Have you ever had those times where you're like, "God, where the heck are you?" Because I know that's what people say. I know they say heck. At Blue Water Mission, that's what we say. That's the four-letter word of choice. Where the heck are you, God? But if instead of saying, "What's wrong with you, Lord?" you say, "You're my God. You got this. We got this. I seek you." That's the shift. And on that little shift, "I seek you" versus "Where are you?" on that little shift, often hinges our souls, or at least the strength of our souls, if you know what I mean, if you can pull that off. That's how you know you're for real. It's a great thing to know you're for real with God. It's a great thing. It's a great thing to know that God is real for you. But, you know, guys, it's almost equally great to know that you're real with God, that you're actually a seeker. It's so cool. It's so cool. So many of us doubt ourselves all the time because we're just a little bit fake, yeah? You know, and we know it, don't we? And then God gives you an opportunity. He lays waste to the land. He puts you in a cave in the middle of the desert. And then he says, "Let's practice. Let's practice reality." I know some of you are in places like that. In big and in small ways. If you're not in one, you will be in one currently. But let me just say, as your brother in the Lord, you're for real. You're for real. You know, you're as real as your choices to seek after God. That's it. To say, "Well, first I seek you." First that. Here's a rock. It's something. We can build on that. So Father God, I pray for those of us who are in dry and thirsty places. I pray for those of us who have felt keenly rejection or abandonment or theft. I pray for those who are going through great times and who are blessed beyond measure, that they would not be distracted by conditions, but see the real God in the midst of it. I pray for those of us who are facing death. I pray for those of us who can't figure out how to live. The Lord has given each of you a way to express reality with him. As fancy as a song, as basic as a rock. It can mean your hands in the air or your face on the ground. It's something. And I commend you to it in Jesus' name. Amen.